I've noticed over the past 15 or 20 years, and where I see it going, is that the standard of training and development is getting better, and this is having an incredibly positive effect.
They're very experienced, I'll give them that, but I don't know if they're always open to developing.
Whereas development, I think, is a bit more holistic.
Just coincidentally, south of Sudan, they used to be soldiers, so teaching was very new to them.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this episode of the ELT Upgraders podcast with myself, JC, and we have Mr. Jakey Wooden in the office too. How's it going, Jake?
Awesome, John. Thank you very much for having me back in the office.
My pleasure. So this is the start of a two-part special on a huge topic, I believe. We're going to be speaking to a number of fascinating people from around the world on this particular topic. So what is our topic today, Jake, and why are we looking at it?
Massive. We're going to look at the big picture of what is training and development.
Ooh, okay.
I think we hear these terms, training and development, and they're the catch cry now of everyone wanting more training and wanting more development. So we're going to go around the world and speak to our friends from different places and
Brilliant.
Hear their input.
Brilliant. Do you think those countries, those teachers are asking for training and development really understand maybe the difference as well between training and development? We'll be having a look. Is there a difference? I mean, that's something we'll have a look at today, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I've asked every person that we speak to exactly that question. What do you think? I mean, what's the difference for you?
Well, I think
do you want to leave it to them?
What we'll do, I think we'll hear from them first,
yeah,
and then we'll sort of sum up at the end. Yeah, for sure. So where are we going to be going? What countries are we going to visit, and which people are we going to speak to?
All right, well, we've got seven people, and we're going to do this as a two-part episode, so you can listen to this one and listen to the next one straight after. So we have from Dubai, Anna Hasper. I won't tell you anymore. We have all the way from South Sudan, one of the newest countries in the world. Actually, the newest country in the world, Joe McDonald, fascinating guy. Hailing from the UK, we have Ben Beaumont, who runs Trinity College Qualifications. We have Tracy Yu from Beijing in China. We have Suzanne Savage, great name. Suzanne Savage, who runs a number of international schools in Papua New Guinea, working with local teachers and international teachers there. We have Stuart Allen, who's based out of Xi'an, but runs a very, very well-known social media group called Tefl Lemon. And finally, we have the guys from Nile. We won't tell you what Nile is, though, yet. They're not from the Nile.
Not from Egypt.
Yeah. So do you want to get started? Where are we going to first, John?
I think we're going to take a flight maybe with Emirates to somewhere in the middle of the world there, the Middle East, I think. And I think it's Dubai.
Yep. Let's hear from...
I'm Anna Hesper. I'm a freelance teacher trainer and teacher development specialist. And I'm based in Dubai at the moment in the UAE. I train on CELTAs, Module 3 Delta, TKT, Young Learners courses, and do some writing here and there for different publishers, and teacher training for different publishers. Interesting question, actually, because if you asked me if there's a difference, I would say yes for me, personally. I would say training is probably more a pre-service where you develop certain skills or give teachers skills to enable learning. And I would say if I speak about development for me personally, that means that you build on existing skills that maybe in-service teachers already have but want to take to the next level. So more developing the skills to enhance that learning in the classroom.
And so what would you say your role is? Do you train people or do you develop people?
I think a little bit of both, actually, because like when you do CELTA, quite often you work with people that have never taught before. So you're really putting the basics in place. So you're really raising awareness of things they need to, the knowledge they need to develop, content knowledge, pedagogical knowledge, also cultural knowledge, because we work in the Middle East, so that's maybe a bigger part as well.
But I also do a lot of development, because a lot of programs I work on for the Ministry of Education, you're working with very experienced teachers who you're trying to just bring up to the next level. So a bit of both, and also, yeah.
Tell us more about the teachers, some of the teachers you train in the Middle East. Give us a Middle East perspective.
A Middle Eastern perspective. Really interesting. I work all over the Gulf region, which I make a distinction between the Gulf and the Middle East. So like Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman, Dubai, and then I work a lot in Jordan and Egypt and Morocco as well. A lot of teachers here in Dubai, for example, are expats, Americans, Canadians, Australians, New Zealanders, and we've got a lot of teachers from Jordan, Syria, Palestine. Certain teachers are really, really keen to develop, and I noticed that as well when I train, for example, in Morocco. Teachers are very keen to get new knowledge and practice and experiment with it, whereas the old group of teachers that have been here, for example, for 25 years, I don't know if they're that motivated or willing to take on board what we try to say. They're very experienced, I'll give them that, but I don't know if they're always open to developing, because yeah, it's a job more so than maybe a passion.
You were telling me about a training you did the other day in Oman.
Yeah, I was somewhere in it was really interesting. I had a lot of teachers who were new to the field, and a lot of teachers were very passionate about what they were doing. And then there was this one table in the corner where the bags were still on the table, books weren't opened, and it was more or less like, you know, they obviously had been in the field for a long time, possibly at the same university, and there was just no intrinsic motivation to actually be there. They had to attend the session because it's part of their yearly PD program, but it was more or less like, really? Do you want me to do an activity in pairs? Why? And that makes it quite hard, I think, as a trainer. I can deal with it, but I always believe that teachers need to be willing to develop. You can have the most beautiful materials and sessions and podcasts, but if there's no willingness or motivation in the teacher themselves to actually deliver or do the best they can, sometimes you wonder, what's the value of this training for you?
Yeah, and why do you think that they don't feel like they have to keep on developing? When do you think that stops in them?
I don't really know, actually. I don't know what you feel, because you're very much out in the field as well, working with a variety of people. Some people see it as probably a way to make a living, more as a job. And other teachers see it as a passion or something they're very enthusiastic about. Those teachers are keen to take anything on board and at least have a go, whereas some teachers who maybe just see it as a job, like, okay, pays the bills, they might just not be that willing in investing their own time outside of the classroom into developing themselves, because they might see it's part of what the employer should offer me, and it shouldn't be in my own time or my own efforts. So I don't know if it's got to do with how long you have been teaching. I don't know, maybe it's a personality thing.
Do you think that a teacher needs to have some intrinsic belief in wanting to constantly develop?
I would say yes, because I think the world we are teaching in is changing. If we keep on teaching the way we have been taught, you know, we are not preparing our learners, especially when you work with young learners or teenagers, we are not preparing them for the future, because you don't know, it's going to be completely different to the way we got taught. So I do think it requires for some teachers a shift in mindset, because they have to take accountability for their own learning. They have to maybe become familiar with technology or certain things that they haven't worked with before, just to keep up with what resonates with their learners. Yeah, I think for some people it's really, they need a bit of a push.
Yeah. And Anna, you've taught in many countries and trained in many countries around the world. Where have you enjoyed training the most?
Very good question. I think for me, it's been Africa. I did some projects for the British Council in Ethiopia and Senegal, and I worked in Uganda as well. And I think for me, there was so much I could give them. The teachers in Africa, most of the time, not trained teachers, I think they get in the school. So they don't have the pedagogical knowledge, the knowledge about how kids develop. They don't have the resources that we have. So they're really keen in finding out how they can deal within their local constraints. So a very little idea that could really enrich their practice, they were so grateful for, but also the people are so positive, keen to try.
And what do you think are the biggest changes you've seen in the time you've been a trainer in this industry?
Interesting, because the first thing that pops into my mind is the changes I haven't seen in certain areas. As mm-hmm. you might know, as a CELTA trainer, our teaching is a lot more technology-based, whereas CELTA is actually still quite focusing on the curriculum they have set, but there's not a lot of focus on how to use curriculum in the technology. There might be one input session. Because I do think that's definitely what has changed the most in my field. A lot of training used to be face-to-face. It's getting too expensive, but also it's not necessary anymore. You've got Skype calls, you've got different ways of setting up Moodles and Blackboard. There's a lot more online work happening. Now, I'm not always sure if that's a positive,
mm-hmm.
But moving away from face-to-face means that teachers can take more responsibility for their learning as well. They can have access to it whenever they want to.
And where do you see things in 5 years or 10 years? What direction do you think we're going in?
The other thing, I think young learners, as you know, that's growing. That market is getting so big, and I don't really get why the while extension is going. But I think that market will keep growing. More and more teachers will have to teach younger learners, and maybe even very young learners. So that's probably one area I see growing a lot. And I think online or maybe blended delivery of training courses will keep growing, and there might be even different providers like we now have Bridge Council IH and a couple of other courses. There might be more online available for teachers.
Cool.
So that's probably what, I don't know if that's a change, but I think there will be more available and possibly even that you can download it so that teachers in Africa can actually use the modules while they're not online, because that is still an issue with access to internet in some places.
What do you feel, one thing that a lot of people have raised is this idea of what do you think will be the role of the international teacher and the local teacher? Do you think that will change in the coming years?
Well, I don't know. I always believe that what we do as teacher trainers, going to other countries and train local teachers, we're actually helping ourselves out of a job. But that's great, because we're empowering the local teachers. So, yeah, in a way, I think we're probably getting more local teachers that become better skills in the school. So there's maybe less need to have international teachers or expat teachers around. So you're empowering your local communities.
Mm.
That will definitely, that's what I hope that happens, because the local teachers often understand the cultural aspects of teaching and the local constraints better than we expats do.
Okay.
At least that's my feeling.
And do you have any final words? If you're a teacher now, a less experienced teacher, and you want to develop further, any advice to our listeners out there, Anna Hasper?
Get your hands on everything you can. You know, if there is online training, use it, look at it. If there are any free courses, there's loads out there on the internet, on Facebook, there's great links. Go for it. But in the end, I think we also have to be aware as teachers, it's not about us, it's not about our teaching. It's really about how do we optimize that learning in the classroom for our learners. So there is a difference between knowing when you do all these courses and being able to apply it in your classroom. So if you get all those ideas online, great, but actually challenge yourself to see, now try to apply it in my class and start reflecting on if it works and why it doesn't work or what you could change to make it work better. I think that's something we need to take accountability for our own learning in that way and be flexible with the ideas we get given. Because if you work in a context in Africa, the ideas I might give you from a high technology environment in Dubai might not be applicable directly. So see how you can adapt it to your local context and reflect on what you do and enjoy the experience, because it's great fun being in the classroom and seeing your learners improve and enhance their performance. So,
wow. Well, thank you very much, Anna. That was lovely. Thanks for coming.
You're welcome,
for
Jay.
Calling in today from all the way from Dubai. And I hope that everything's
So that was Anna Hasper, some very interesting insights there from maybe sort of different viewpoints from those teachers maybe that are quite happy with the status quo, don't want to rock the boat too much.
The longer term. And...
Yeah. And then those who are a little bit more sort of hungry for training sort of development as
do
well.
And do you find the same in Asia? I mean, she was talking about the Middle East and Oman and Morocco there.
I think with inside a country you get the differences of teachers, but also I think between countries as well. You take somewhere like Vietnam, and we're currently doing a lot of sort of online sort of webinars and things like that, trying to new ways of sort of professional development. And the numbers of Vietnamese who are now signing up for these types of events is incredible, and they're hungry, and they want to learn, and
that's great,
which is really really interesting as well. So
I think what she mentions there raises that, don't you know? Often people say to you, "Oh, I have 15 years experience," but was it the same year 15 times, or was it 15 years experience? So that's a little trap that people can fall into.
Indeed.
But we hope none of our listeners would do that.
Absolutely not.
No.
So who's up next?
Now we're going to travel. We're going to head south from Dubai and down to the newest country in the world. Let's hear from...
Joe McDonald. I'm a teacher trainer. I'm currently working in China. I've worked in a few other locations as well. Most recently in South Sudan.
Can you just tell everyone where is South Sudan? What is a South Sudan?
South Sudan is still, I believe, the newest country in the world. If you look at a map of Africa, it's very, very central Africa, and it's just coincidentally south of Sudan, and it's South Sudan.
So tell us, when did you go there? And in what capacity?
I was there throughout the year of 2013, and I went and did a project with the Sudan People's Liberation Army, and I was there for the first few months of the year, and then I went back four times throughout the year to do ongoing support and development.
And what did the project entail?
The project was through DFID and the British Council, and the main goal was to help the army get its own English training program that would be run and taught by their own members. So they were all soldiers.
Oh, they were soldiers. What was it? So what was an average day like?
Well, for the first 2 months, every day was us going on to the base and meeting with the soldiers that were selected to become English teachers, and going through daily training sessions to teach them how to teach English.
Doing what type of thing? What type of training would you do?
Well, South Sudan is a bit interesting. They did this. They chose English to be their national language, but the overall proficiency of English in the country, I think, still needs to be upgraded. So some of the training sessions were grammar-based, kind of grammar awareness to get them up on that. And the other training sessions were very similar to what you would find on CELTA program.
And what issues came up with the training? What were the biggest challenges?
Lots of challenges. These... You know, they used to be soldiers, so teaching was very new to them. So it was a very to basics approach when it came to training.
And for those type of teachers, do you think they would even care about the difference between training and development? Was there any development in it, or was it all just pure training?
You know, with all training and development, you know, training is kind of that initial thing. And I think all teachers and all people and all professions want development. And so even these teachers, when they did first start, after a few months, they understood the basics that we had taught them, and they wanted to know, you know, what's next? How can I get better? What should I be doing?
Mm-hmm. And what type of backgrounds, like educational backgrounds or backgrounds, did these soldiers have?
Completely mixed, because they had come from all over the country, but they were now living in the capital of Juba. We had one woman. We had a mix of officers and non-commissioned soldiers, and different levels of English, and different backgrounds, different economic backgrounds.
Compared to your experience training and developing in Asia and around China, what was the biggest differences about training there?
Very few resources. So I guess one of the biggest differences would be doing development on how to work with a lack of resources. They also needed a lot more adapting materials that they did have, because very few materials would be written with the type of context that they were in and who they were teaching.
You got any examples?
When we look at a lot of textbooks, you know, there's always things like talking about rooms in a house and furniture that you have, but, you know, a lot of these people, their house is a room, and it doesn't really have furniture per se. So it's difficult to have these lessons with, you know, this is this room in the house and things like that.
And what about this in general, the resources in a classroom that they would be teaching in? What were you preparing them for? What would the environment they would be teaching in look like?
Better than you would imagine. There's still, we were on base, so we had at first we were in a tent, which we had divided into different rooms, but eventually we had a building which had classrooms and desks and a whiteboard and an overhead fan and everything.
Oh, advanced tech, yeah, right. And what, as a trainer living there, what was it like living in South Sudan as a trainer? Just your daily life?
It's difficult. There's not much to do. You don't really want to go out that much. It's extremely hot. So you kind of go from one guarded compound to another guarded compound, and meeting other foreigners and expats that are in the area doing different types of projects.
So if anyone was aspiring to go and work in a place like that, what advice would you give them?
My main advice for people wanting to go to somewhere like Sudan is make sure that you're joining a program where you can actually add benefit to the place where you're going. You know, these places need money, they need resources, and to bring in trainers and to bring in people, it's a massive expense. So you want to make sure that you have some program that you're joining where you're going to be really adding value to the area that you're going.
And then, what, you were there in 2013, you're not there now. Well, why aren't you there now, training?
Well, at the end of 2013, beginning of 2014, the latest civil war broke out, so most programs and expat organizations moved out.
Yeah, right, so no teaching in the war zone. What do you think will be the future of teacher development there? Do you hear anything, or do you have, I mean, your own opinions? What would you like to see happen in South Sudan? And
well, I think South Sudan will always exist, and I think that they've chosen English as their language, so there's always going to be a strong demand for upgrading language in that country. So there's going to be lots of opportunities in the future once things do settle down.
So in South Sudan, Joe, you trained local teachers, I assume. You weren't training foreign teachers to teach there.
No, these were all local teachers selected from the People's Liberation Army.
Which is fascinating. So the concept of an international teacher is not necessarily... You're starting with the local teachers over there, right? It's not bringing all the international teachers and then later we'll train up the local teachers?
Yeah, I mean, there's still... At the time, the British Council still had foreign teachers coming over and running programs, but the main idea with a lot of programs that was happening in South Sudan, the military, the police, and other government organizations, it was giving them the chance to internalize their training and do it all from within, so that they'd have more control over what they were doing, as well as give the people within their organization more skills.
Yeah, well, I find that really interesting because, you know, there's kind of the exact opposite happens in Asia where, you know, the local teacher sort of is the last thought on some people's training plans, which people have opinions on either way, and most people know my opinion on that, but why do you think in a place like that they're sort of so willing to focus on the local teachers and growing that internally, whereas in a place like here in China or Japan, that's less the case?
It could be availability. I mean, I know that they still do look highly on foreigners and foreign teachers, and, you know, they're automatically kind of given an expert status, but there are very, very few expats in that environment, so that if people do want to improve their education, they have to use the local teachers that they have. Mm-hmm. And I will say as well that in South Sudan, you know, they've had a really difficult recent history, and I did notice when I was there, people, you know, really latch on to education. They see it as, you know, a way to improve their lives drastically. So they're willing and trying everything that they have available to them.
Different places in the world and different conferences. Where do you think teacher training and development will go in the next 10 years in Asia?
Like the physical location, you mean, or the direction of training?
Yeah, direction of training.
I would say in Asia, from what I see in China, it's a real understanding that the level of teaching does need to be improved. You know, you see changes in exams, and you see things like the Gaokao in China, which are going to start introducing more areas of English, as well as kind of more emphasis on proficiency. And so I think when we look at traditional teaching kind of in Asia, the chalk and talk type thing, the presentation, I think there's going to be more of a move to, you know, communicative language teaching.
Anyway, thank you very much, Joe, for coming along today and being on WeChat all the way from Fujian province and telling us some interesting stories about South Sudan. Have a good day. Bye.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Wow, that was a very interesting insight there from South Sudan. Sounds a little bit different from my life here in Shanghai. Fancy going to South Sudan, Jake?
Yeah, not this week, but anyway, he assures me that English teaching will pick up there again. There'll be lots of jobs for people if anyone's interested.
Fantastic. All right, so who's up next? Where are we going next?
We're going to go and head over to UK and hear a very well-spoken gentleman.
Oh, really?
Have a listen to...
Okay, my name is Ben Beaumont, and I run the English Language Teacher Education Qualifications at Trinity College London.
Trinity College London is an international exams board. They've been an exams board since 1877, and they basically run exams over a number of subject areas. Initially, it was music and dance, but they also have drama. They've been running English language teaching qualifications, like the graded exams and spoken English and integrated skills exams, since the 1930s, and have been running teacher education qualifications since the 1960s. So now they have a whole suite of different qualifications, of which the TESOL section, the Teaching English to Speakers of Other Language qualifications, is one part of this overall mighty machine of Trinity.
Which would be your biggest or most known qualifications?
But for TESOL, the biggest qualification is the CERT TESOL, the initial teacher education qualification at level 5 on the qualifications framework. So that's your entry point. And people will probably have heard of the DIP TESOL as well, the advanced level 7, the master's level teaching qualification, which requires you to take an exam, do some independent research, sit a phonology interview, and also do some assessed teaching practice. So those are our two largest or most popular teaching qualifications, and there are a number of smaller teaching qualifications as well. The TILEC, which specializes in young learners, the CERT IBET for business teachers, the CERT ICT to promote ICT, and the DELT M, a management qualification we run with English UK.
And did you do any of those courses, Ben?
Yes, I certainly did. So I did the CERT TESOL back in 2001, many years ago. And then after a couple of years, I did my Delta, and then I moved into the state sector a bit. But yeah, it really all started with the CERT TESOL back 15 years ago. to everyday purposes, they're the same thing. The qualification itself is actually the name, the item. Is it a CERT TESOL? Is it a CELT? That is a qualification. And you therefore have some kind of certificate that you get with this qualification. And this is perhaps where there is this crossover. You have a certificate so that you're certified. You have a qualification so that you're qualified. The qualification does, I suppose, this is where the semantics breaks down a bit, because just because you're qualified, it doesn't necessarily mean you have a qualification, because you could be qualified to bake a cake. And what qualifies me to bake a cake is that I've got a lot of experience as a baker, but I don't actually have a qualification in baking. So maybe my qualities, which allow me to be qualified to bake a cake, maybe limit the type of cake I can make. Similarly with certification, the semantics aren't quite so straightforward. It doesn't necessarily mean you have a certificate, or a certificate that is the same as a qualification. Certification could be from a licensing authority. So you could be certified to be a lawyer, but it doesn't necessarily mean you have got a certificate or qualification to be a lawyer, although maybe with that particular job, it means it's unlikely you wouldn't have a qualification in law. So the semantics aren't as straightforward. I think for all intents and purposes, they're the same. But
what do you use internally when you're talking internally?
So I always use when I'm talking about the exams we have at Trinity College, I always use qualification. And I suppose certification, or if you're certified, that's more something that comes from a licensing authority.
Okay.
A better example might be that if you have a PGCE in the UK state sector to teach, you need a PGCE. But the PGCE is only the qualification. In order to become a teacher, you need to sign up to the General Teaching Council. And for that, you need to get your QTS or QTLS. So whereas the PGCE is the qualification, the QTS or QTLS, the Qualified Teacher Status, is the certification.
So the qualified teacher case is the certification. The acronym stands for qualified teacher status, which is the certification, which is
exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So that didn't clear it up at all. Thank you very. No, I'm joking.
I don't know.
Was very very clear.
No. It, but possibly nothing at all.
No, I'm
too. But basically, the semantics, the root noun and the verb and the adjective all have slightly different meanings.
Yeah. Yeah. How do these two words work together, training and development?
Well, I think, first of all, they do work together, exactly as you suggest. And it's something of a Venn diagram. There's lots of overlap between the two, depending on the context and what you're talking about. I think we might almost see development as like a hyperordinate, which encompasses training. Because for me, training is for a specific purpose. You might train someone to do something in a classroom. You'll train someone to be a mentor. You'll train someone on using an interactive whiteboard. Training has a specific purpose. And I think within a qualification, there's lots of training. So if we take the CERT TESOL, for example, within that qualification, there's training to convey knowledge, there's training to set up tasks, there's training to diagnostically assess students, all those kinds of things. Whereas development, I think, is a bit more holistic. The training fits into that.
Mm.
So the development can also be about your personal development, your personal growth as well. Development would include things like reflection, reflective practice. Training, if you were trained in reflective practice, maybe you might look at Gibbs or Kolb's theory of reflection or Mesereau's theory of reflection. And that's the training part. But the actual development is when you're doing it, when you're actually reflecting, engaging in reflective or indeed reflexive practice, we could argue. So if we take those two concepts and whittle them down, we could say that maybe the training is finding out how to do it, but the development is actually doing it.
Mm.
And again, taking the example back to the CERT TESOL, we could say that on the course, you've got 130 hours on the CERT TESOL, you're trained to do certain things, but you don't really learn how to do them. You don't really learn how to put all those things into practice until you actually start teaching itself. And that's a long journey of teaching. And that process of teaching is the development of both you and as a person and as a teacher. Much as when you take a driving test, the driving instructor trains you, but you don't actually know how to drive properly. That comes with all the experience of putting that training into practice when you're actually on the road driving. That's when you really develop those skills.
So from your experience over the last 15, 20 years, you've obviously seen a lot of changes in training, development and qualifications. I think things have, the quality and the expectations of what teachers need for training, development and qualification has risen. And I think right now, it's every place I enter, okay, the first thing they ask me is, what can you do for training, development and qualifications? Which I didn't hear as much 5-10 years ago. So where do you see the future of training and development going from your perspective, as from where you are at Trinity?
I see it, first of all, getting better. I think before I drill down into specifics, I think what I've noticed over the past 15 or 20 years and where I see it going is that the standard of training and development is getting better, and this is having an incredibly positive effect on the teachers and ultimately, of course, the learners. The teaching that the learners are getting is just really raising in quality. And much as you say, when you walk in somewhere and people ask you, what can you do about training and development? People are aware of this now. They know that just being a native English speaker isn't enough, indeed, if it ever was enough. And they know that something like a Cert Tis Floris Alta is just an initial teacher education qualification. And the best teachers are the ones that really want to move on, really want to develop themselves and get something like the DIPTIS or the Delta. And, of course, the interesting thing for schools is, especially, that the teachers that have at least a Cert Tis Floris Alta, and then even better, a DIPTIS or Delta, they're the ones that maybe take their job more seriously. They're the ones that also might put in that extra time or just that extra effort to make sure their students are getting the lessons they deserve. And not only do, I suppose, teachers with those higher level qualifications tend to be easier to retain because they're more committed as teachers, they're not just doing the job for a year and then doing something else. They also have higher retention for students as well, because the students notice a good teacher. Mm-hmm. Students have got hours and hours of time in front of countless numbers of teachers, and they can identify when there's a good or a bad teacher. So the very long-winded answer to that first part of the question, where is it going? I see that in an abstract sense, I see it going upwards in terms of quality.
I think the, if you don't mind me really quickly interrupting, what you said about students was very interesting, because I think as students become more aware of what quality teaching is, you know, in the fact that, let's just say from a China perspective, they're, you know, a lot of these students, they're highly educated with teachers who were already highly educated. So we're sort of moving into another generation now that are expecting a much higher quality standard in the classroom. And I have seen students recently turning around and saying, I didn't like that class. Oh, why? Well, the teacher wasn't really doing any collaborative work, and I wasn't really pushed to do anything creative, so I didn't really feel like I was developing myself as a learner. And I thought, you're the student, and you know, you're more aware of what's going on with teaching than even a lot of the teachers are. So I think that's a good thing if the students are driving the need for more quality and development and training. That was just a side note.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think as teachers, we really need to take more account of what the students say or what they notice or what they need. I think we've got to be careful, especially for those people that might deal with Cert Tis Floris Alta or other qualifications, and they go into a classroom and think, I'm the native speaker, I know best. And in many cases, they don't. And I think we just need to be careful that we have our kind of cultural sensitivities when we're going into places and realizing that, you know, the students do have this experience, as you say. They do know what good teaching is, and we need to react to that. And I think that's a very positive thing, because that just forces teachers to up their game and just improves that quality of education.
So, sorry, I interrupted your second point, if you remember what it was. You were saying... Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, interestingly, the second point links in a little bit to the idea of the students being better aware of what good teaching is. The second point about training and development for English language teaching qualifications is really the growth of acceptance for non-native English-speaking teachers. Previously, a student might have been happy with anyone coming in as long as they were a native speaker, and the teaching would have been appalling, but because they were a native speaker, they thought, okay, this is good. But as students become more aware and schools become more aware of what good teaching is, they realize that being a native speaker isn't enough. And in many cases, if you've got a non-native English speaking teacher who's got lots of experience teaching English, previously they would have been sidelined in favor of a native English speaker. This is becoming less so, and it's a very, very positive change to the industry, I think, where we're slowly accepting, the industry is slowly accepting, schools are slowly accepting, and students are slowly accepting, that being a native speaker, it isn't a native English speaker isn't necessarily what people want. And I think this is also driving an increase in quality in English language teaching worldwide.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And I think it's a very positive change. Anyway, Ben, is there any other final points you'd like to say about training and development or qualifications in the future to the listeners?
I think the important thing for teachers to recognise is that the sector is professionalising, and it's always been professional to an extent, but it's becoming more so. So if someone wants to make a career out of English language teaching, and there are lots of careers available, it's not just something you can do for a year or two. You can do it for the rest of your life, as hopefully I'm an example of the kind of person that's done that. You need to upskill. You need to constantly be engaging in training. You need to make sure your qualifications are updated. You need to make sure you know what's going on, just so you can remain at the forefront of a really interesting and ever-changing industry. And I think if teachers do that, if they don't rest on their laurels, they can really continue to enjoy a very productive career in English language teaching.
Thank you very much, Ben Beaumont. I feel very refreshed now. I can be positive again. Thank you, Ben.
My pleasure. If I can do that, I'll take the rest of the day off. My job is done. Inspirational. So Trinity College London.
So that was Ben. Pretty interesting stuff again. And yeah, pretty much agree. Constant upskilling or upgrading of your skills.
Yeah. It was funny talking to Ben, because I always feel like I have upgraded myself or upskilled and I'm reading enough. But talking to him on parts that weren't recorded, the reason I didn't include them was because I couldn't understand what he meant, because it was too high. It was too much higher than my
really?
Level.
Oh, really?
So, Ben Beaumont's a fascinating human being, and I'm sure in the future he'll be a published person or something, because he's got a lot of really interesting insights, but I found myself a little bit out of my league.
There you go.
Yeah, which is nice. It means I need to upskill.
Done.
And
all
upgrade.
Right. Thanks for Ben for upskilling our views on professional development, but also on English accents, I think, as well.
Oh, yes, he does have
absolutely.
A lovely accent.
So that was a view from three trainers, guys working with training, professional development around the world. So that's our first episode.
Yeah,
on this topic. As we said, a huge topic.
40 years of experience from those three as well, which is excellent.
Fantastic. And if that interests you, then we've got an episode two coming up very shortly, where we'll be travelling to further reaches of the world. We'll be going to China.
Yep.
Where else?
Papua New Guinea.
Well, I believe
no one knows where that is.
Did you grow up in Papua New Guinea?
Well, I spent quite a few years there growing up, and still have connections there.
Fantastic.
If you don't know where it is, type it in. Papua New Guinea. It's not New Guinea as in Equatorial New Guinea in Africa. It's just above Australia.
Wonderful. And so, I met a few guys from Papua New Guinea last week, and they were telling me about their local languages. And it's an English curriculum there, isn't it? But they speak some sort of Creole or something.
Pidgin.
Okay.
And it's recognised as one of their national languages. And it's funny with the pidgin there, because people in, you know, linguisticians, and people can be quite posh about, oh, pidgin, it's not a real language. But it's a very beautiful language with its own poetry and its own novels and things. So, yeah, it's probably not really a pidgin, even though pidgins are not considered their own language. But the pidgin in Papua New Guinea would be its own language.
Absolutely.
Fascinating.
And that's not pidgins with wings, right?
No,
that's something in the linguistic form, right?
If anyone wants to look it up, it's P-I-D-G-I-N.
Done. All right. I'm fully upskilled.
Yeah.
So Papua New Guinea, and we'll be jumping across also to...
Also in China, in Xi'an, we're going to speak to a guy, fascinating guy, who has his own, some of you might be members of it, massive reach with an online social media teacher resource place called TEFL Lemon.
Wow, fantastic. Yeah. Look forward to hearing from them. And then we'll also be talking to a representative or trainer from NILE, NILE Institute of Training.
Yeah.
Based out of...
The Norwich Institute of Training, even.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Norwich, based there in the UK, famous for...
have no idea.
Alan Partridge.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, you. Oh, Alan.
Yeah.
Good old Alan.
So they'll be talking...
Who's Alan Partridge?
You never seen Alan Partridge?
No, I think we didn't. That didn't make it to Australia.
Oh, we had Neighbours. Poor you.
I used to watch Neighbours. Neighbours was a good show.
Yeah.
If it was Harold Bishop, I'd remember.
Probably would have done, yeah, yeah. So Niall will be giving a bit of a global look, actually, on some online...
The Global Classroom.
The Global Classroom.
Mm, and what is a Global Classroom?
Ooh, absolutely. So we look forward to hearing from Niall as well. So until the next episode, good luck with your teaching.
Yep, and see you all soon. Bye-bye.
This podcast was brought to you by Macmillan Education Asia and the ELT Upgraders.